I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we'll talk to the creator of one of my favorite websites, walkscore.com. Matt Lerner is the chief technology officer of frontseat.org, a company that builds software for civic life. He'll tell us about making software that makes the world a better place. And we'll talk to Sadhu Johnston. Sadhu is completing his tenure as Chicago's chief environmental officer, where he's been making Chicago a better place. I'll ask him about the challenges of making real change in the city and how cities are cooperating instead of competing to make a difference in climate change. All that, plus the latest news from Planet Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. If you are a regular listener of our show, you've heard us talk about walkscore.com. It's a site that lets you provide your address or any address and get a walk score based on the daily destinations that are within easy walking distance. Today, my guest is one of the creators of WalkScore, Matt Lerner. Matt is the chief technology officer for the software company Frontseat. Frontseat builds software for civic life. That's a very big playing field. How do you decide, Matt, which projects to pursue?
Well, it's too big a playing field. We should probably get more specific. You know, we've done stuff related to the environment, voting, government transparency, but WalkScore, our walkability site, is really our favorite project. We think it's the project we're doing that has the most impact, and so we're going to be focusing in that direction.
What led you to build WalkScore? Where did the impulse come from?
The impulse came from a great think tank in the Northwest called the Sightline Institute, and they publish a booklet called the Cascadia Scorecard that measures the health and wealth of the Northwest. And that booklet had a picture of a map in a cul-de-sac suburban neighborhood and showed everything you could walk to there, which wasn't much, and a picture of a nice, tight urban grid and everything you could walk to there. And we saw those two maps and just thought they were crying out for a Google Maps mashup. So we built WalkScore so that you could see those maps and get a WalkScore for any address.
Now, for any listener who may not know WalkScore.com, describe how it works.
So anyone can go to walkscore.com and type in their address, and they'll get a personalized walkability score from 0 to 100 that tells you how walkable your house is and how easy it is to get by there without a car. You'll also see a list of all the nearby amenities. You can see street view of what's nearby and really get a sense of the neighborhood as you're looking for a home to buy or a place to rent, or maybe you're just curious what your own walk score is.
What is your walk score?
Mine is 95,
Whoa.
And I grew up in Kansas, where my walk score was probably in the 40s, because I grew up in Topeka, Kansas, and I'm so passionate about walkability, because I've really lived the difference, and you know, now I ride my two-year-old in his bike trailer to preschool. We might stop by a coffee shop on the way. I can stop home, grab a few groceries on the way back to the house, and I might get in the car once or twice a week, and for me, that's just a great lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Let's be clear, WalkScore doesn't really measure walkability. It measures proximity, right? Proximity to multiple uses or multiple destinations.
That's right. And in fact, one of the things we're trying to do with WalkScore is in the real estate world, we're trying to help define what it means for a house to be walkable, because real estate agent might say, you know, this house is on a golf course, it's walkable, or this house is out in the middle of nowhere, but there is a trail nearby, so that's walkable. And we're trying to define walkable as easy to live there without needing your car for everything.
Ah, I like that. And then, of course, there's the sort of quality of the walking experience on top of that. So in other words, what you're not measuring today is the width of sidewalks or the delightfulness of the walk or even the ease of the walk. I mean, whether it's uphill or across the lake. I love there's a comment on your website that says if you live on a lake and let's say there's a restaurant on the other side of the lake, we're assuming that you're swimming.
Right. That, and, you know, one of the things we're excited about this year at WalkScore is fixing some of the things that we know could be improved. Right now, you know, we like to think that our job is sort of to convince 100% of the people that WalkScore is 80% accurate. And sort of getting that last 20% is very hard. And in some ways, it's subjective. But we know that there are some things we can do that'll make it more accurate. One of the things, as you mentioned, is actually looking at the road network. And there isn't public data on where there are or aren't sidewalks. But we can look at things like how fast is the road? If the speed limit is 55 miles an hour, that is not a pleasant place to walk. You know, how wide is the road? If it's wider than three lanes, that's a hard road to cross on foot. So we can start looking at those kinds of things as a proxy for pedestrian friendliness. And hopefully this year we'll get transit into WalkScore. We'll get that road network analysis in. And, you know, we think for the purposes of someone trying to find a walkable home, WalkScore already helps you find those, and it'll be more, even more accurate at the end of this year.
Oh, I completely agree that you should never let perfect be the enemy of the good. And certainly WalkScore is very good as it is today. What goes into building something like WalkScore? It brings together such an interesting array of data.
That's right. And, you know, what's been most interesting for us about building WalkScore is that there's this near unanimous consensus among urban planners about the benefits of walkable, transit-oriented neighborhoods. But if you're someone who's maybe looking for a house to buy online or looking for an apartment to rent online, there's nothing on that real estate listing that helps you find a smart growth neighborhood. And so our whole goal with building it is to take the stuff that urban planners already know and talk about and make that easy for people to see on real estate listings. And so because of that, a lot of the work we've done on WalkScore has been to make it easy to add WalkScore to real estate listings. So now we've got two of the top 10 real estate sites showing WalkScore on all their listings. If you go to Zillow.com, they show a million WalkScores a day just on that one website. And our whole goal is to make walkability and transportation costs and transit part of how people think about buying a home or renting an apartment.
Is that the reason that WalkScore has taken off, because so many other organizations to use WalkScore to their own benefit?
I think we're in a funny position where WalkScore is almost surfing from crisis to crisis. When we launched it a couple years ago, people were very concerned about global warming. And I think people were thinking about walkability as an easy way to reduce their environmental impact. Last year, gas hit $4 a gallon, and people were thinking about walkability as a way to reduce their gas prices. And this year, with the suburban housing bubble bursting, people are thinking of walkable neighborhoods as better investments. So I hate to say it, but in a way, we've been kind of surfing from crisis to crisis, I think, in terms of why it resonates with people.
I want to talk about some of the other things you've developed. Develop something I think has great potential. You call it Better Bills. All utilities, in my opinion, ought to be using it. Describe Better Bills.
Better Bills was a pretty simple idea, which is that people would be more willing to conserve energy if they knew how their energy usage compared to their neighbors. So we redesigned the Seattle electric and water bills so that when you got the bill, it would show you how you compare to the people near you in terms of your energy usage. So you might think you're an environmentalist, but then when you find out you use 50% more energy than your neighbors, you might be more likely to screw in some compact fluorescent bulbs or get the double-paned windows. While we were working on this project, we found a for-profit company called Positive Energy USA that is doing this, had already done a pilot in Sacramento and is rolling this out to a number of other cities. And so we've sort of realized that project is best done as a for-profit company. And so we've been interacting with the folks at Positive Energy USA, and we hope that they're very successful, because what they're doing is a very cheap way to get people to conserve by using comparative psychology and getting people to compare themselves to their neighbors.
Well, building, and we have learned that comparative psychology is very important. Have you thought about other places that might have application that would be useful to people and useful to cities?
Well, last month we launched a compare your walk score feature. So if you go to walkscore.com and type in your address, we now tell you how your walk score compares to the top 10% in your city and the average in your city. And we're hoping that, you know, that'll help someone in Seattle who says, oh, great, I got a walk score of 70, not feel so great when they see that, you know, the top 10% in Seattle is in the high 90s. But I think I just read the book Nudge, which is about how to sort of nudge people towards better decision making. And they talk a lot about comparative psychology. And not only that, but how you present these things to people. And one of the points in the book they made is that, you know, people respond more to threats than opportunities. So in terms of conservation, if you say you can save $200 by conserving, that's actually less powerful than saying if you don't conserve, you're going to have to pay $200.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Matt Lerner of the software company Front Seat. We're talking about how to create signals and incentives that encourage people to live greener lifestyles.
It's interesting, isn't it? How do you take those? You read a book like Nudge. How do you then apply it to your work?
Well, for us, we think about those comparisons a lot because when we think about walk score, we want people to really think about the trade-offs that they make if they're in a drive till you qualify mindset. There are a lot of real estate buyers who say things like, well, I really want that extra bedroom. I'm willing to drive 15 minutes more each day to get that extra bedroom in the house. And, you know, they're not factoring in the transportation costs. They're not thinking about the environmental impact. It's hard to even estimate the community differences between living in a place where everyone, you know, gets in their car and drives out versus walks out and meets their neighbors. We just want to make all of that stuff transparent so that it's easier for people to see the trade-offs. And one of the best examples we have of trade-offs that people need a little bit more information to really think about is that the average American spends $9,000 per year on their car. And if you translate that into a mortgage, that's a $135,000 mortgage.
That's astonishing, isn't it?
It's astonishing. And I have so many friends in Seattle who cannot afford to get into even a starter condo here. But if they did the math and they got rid of their car, they actually might be able to afford it. And so we want to make those trade-offs clear to people as they're thinking about where to live.
Mm-hmm. That's terrific. You've also tackled voting. You said that earlier. You launched something called CountMore.org to encourage college students to vote in the place their vote will count more. I presume that's the difference between their hometown and where they're now going to school. How does it work?
CountMore is another example of providing more transparency to people. College students are in the unique position of being able to vote in their home state or in the state where they go to school. And if you're from a competitive state like Ohio and you're going to school in an uncompetitive state like Kansas, your vote counts more if you vote in Ohio. And one of the things we are trying to do with that site also is to educate college students about the Electoral College and to get them to ask questions about it. A lot of them said, well, why should my vote count more in one state rather than another? I mean, that doesn't really make sense. And we think that's a great question for them to be asking.
Isn't it, though? What problem would you like to tackle, Matt, with software that you haven't yet been able to tackle?
I think the biggest opportunity and the thing we're most interested in, and also the thing that we don't have any great ideas on yet, is the power of software is that you can get a lot of people to do small things. So Wikipedia is a great example of that. A lot of people wrote a few articles and now they have a full encyclopedia online. YouTube is another example. A lot of people uploaded a few videos. Now they have an incredible amount of footage online. And with cities, so many people have a sense of civic duty and would like to contribute something to their city. We would like to use software to make that much easier. There are simple ideas around organizing neighbors to do things like park cleanups. But, you know, I think there are also bigger opportunities. And now we're starting to see iPhone apps that let you, you know, report a problem and send it right back to the city. But what if those lists were public and neighbors could get together to fix those things? So that's the opportunity that we're probably most interested in, which is how do you make it easy to be a better citizen?
Well, you know, that's the opportunity I'm most interested in as well. In the same vein, what would you like to do next with WalkScore? You talked about adding transit and the road network, both of which I think are fabulous ideas. What then is next?
We'd love to get to the point where every real estate listing had a measure of location efficiency like WalkScore and a measure of energy efficiency. I just love the quote from Sean Donovan at HUD where he said, you know, when you buy a new car, it's got a sticker on it that tells you the miles per gallon. When you buy a new dishwasher, it's got a sticker on it that tells you how much it's going to cost to operate each year. How come when you buy a home, it doesn't have a sticker telling you, you know, how much you're going to spend on transportation and how much you're going to spend on utilities for that home?
That would be powerful, wouldn't it?
It would be really powerful and it would really change real estate. The other thing that I think would really change the dynamics of walkable neighborhoods is to get real estate sites to offer more features that make it easy for people to find a walkable or transit-oriented neighborhood. And I'll just give you a few examples of features that don't exist on real estate sites, but I think should exist. Things like, show me all the homes that are within a 30-minute public transit commute of where I work. There are no real estate sites where you can do that. There are a couple small sites now that are letting you do a search that says, show me homes within a half a mile of the light rail with a walk score greater than 90. Those types of ways to look for homes, to make those easy on real estate sites, and to also help people understand the benefits of living in those homes, I think will have a big impact on how people think about buying homes. That increases the demand for walkable neighborhoods. And I like to think of developers as property developers, as mercenaries, and they'll go build more of whatever it is people want.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I want to come back for a minute to an issue you talked about earlier, government transparency. When you think about government transparency, where's the big aha? Where's the big transformative idea there that, in other words, if we made government transparent, then what results?
That's a great question. I'm really excited about the opening up of government data because it lets other people innovate on top of that data. And one good example, I'm interested in voting. So there's a public record of who has voted and when. And if that were in an easy to access format, if that were published in a standard format that computer programmers could use, I promise you, you would see some great get out the vote applications and voter registration applications, and you would see rankings of which neighborhoods in your city vote the most or the least. But even though that information is public right now, it's locked away and pretty hard to get to. So I think open government data, and you've seen cities like San Francisco, for example, just launched a site to open up their data. Obama had a big effort around open government data. And all of those things can lead to innovations that are hard to predict because it makes it easy for, you know, the 20-year-old student in college to write an application nobody else ever thought of.
You're in Seattle, and I don't want to miss an opportunity to ask you to bring me up to date on the Seattle mayor's race. Your current mayor, Greg Nickels, led the U.S. Conference of Mayors, is president, actually. He led the U.S. mayor's signing on to the climate change goals. He was defeated, which was a bit of a surprise. Now you have two relative newcomers who are vying for the position. What do you see happening there?
Well, for anyone interested in the Seattle mayor race, there's a guy named Dan Bertolet who writes a fantastic blog about Seattle called Huge Ass City. And the name is really funny. I love the name. He wrote a great piece on why he thinks Nickels lost. And in essence, he said that he thinks there was a lot of strategic voting where people voted for Mike McGinn, one of the people who made it through the primary, thinking that Nickels would also make it through the primary, and that vote would force Nickels to be more progressive on issues like the tunnel that a lot of people don't want here. So he has this great blog post on why he thinks Nickels didn't make it through, and he says it was because of a lot of that kind of strategic voting. So now we have Mike McGinn, who's been a great organizer for Seattle. He ran the Great City Initiative, which is really about making Seattle, you know, one of the most walkable, transit-friendly, sustainable cities in the country. And then we have Malahan, who was basically a middle manager from T-Mobile.
And the race is, the election is when?
I don't know the exact date. I think it's a couple months from now.
Mm-hmm. So they've got a while to present themselves to the community. I'm curious, as someone who has lived in Seattle a while, you've been there how long?
I've been here about 7 or 8 years.
7 or 8 years. It feels to me like Seattle is a city that's really undergone a lot of change, and all of a sudden it feels like it's grown up. What's your sense of the city today and its future?
That's a great question that I do not feel qualified to answer, but I could hazard a guess.
Well, hazard a guess.
Well, the reason I love Seattle so much is that there are a lot of unique things happening in Seattle, and it's one of the reasons that I plan to stay here, and I love it. What's unique to me about Seattle is you have a lot of very smart technology people here. There is a fair amount of money in the city from Microsoft, Boeing, Amazon, and Starbucks. And it's a beautiful city. Everybody here feels very connected to the mountains, the water, the salmon, the islands, the Northwest. And so you've got this combination of people who really care about the place that they're in, who have money, who are educated and, you know, have been successful at getting things done in the world. And you know, to me, it just means that I think Seattle really should be the most sustainable city in the country. And a lot of people here feel that that's our goal. And that's sort of the destiny that we want Seattle to achieve. And so I think, you know, in terms of the mayor's race, I'm excited about Mike McGinn for that reason. I also think Greg Nichols got a lot of great stuff done for the city, especially on climate and getting the light rail going. But I think the city as a whole, we want to be the most sustainable city in the country.
Matt, it's always fun to talk with you. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much, Carol. It was a pleasure.
Matt Lerner is the Chief Technology Officer for FrontSeat.org and one of the creators of WalkScore. We have links to his site on ours, smartcityradio.com. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
It's been called one of the nation's model transit-oriented developments. But new figures show that the transit part of the Portland area Orenco Station TOD is not living up to expectations. About 2 out of 3 Orenco residents are still driving to work in cars, according to a new paper by sociologist Bruce Podobnik. A recent article from The Oregonian looks at the findings, which call into question the efficacy of the new urbanist design principles that guided the development of Orenco Station. But despite the surprisingly low rate of transit use compared to other suburban communities in the region, the study found that residents had a high rate of walking and biking for non-work trips to places like the grocery store or the park. Rates of carpooling and bicycle commuting are also higher amongst Orenco residents, according to the report. The transit numbers may be lower than expected, but many argue that's just one small part of a much larger and more diverse picture of the state of transportation in the Portland area. Meanwhile, the economic recession is taking its toll across the country. The U.S. median income dropped 3.6% over the last year, and 2.6 million more Americans are now in poverty. These economic changes are redrawing the geography of poverty in the U.S. According to a recent article from Forbes, 3 areas are feeling the brunt of the recession, with sharply rising rates of poverty. Cities in the south, near the U.S.-Mexico border, and around declining manufacturing centers have seen the biggest increases in poverty over the last year. This is based on data from the U.S. Census Bureau's 2008 American Community Survey. The worst-hit region is the southern tip of Texas. The current economic recession is likely to blame for much of the rise in poverty levels, but pre-existing trends like the downfall of the industrial sector are indicators that poverty will likely continue to rise in parts of the country like these for years to come. And as poverty increases, more and more Americans are losing their homes to foreclosure. As a result, the nation's homeless shelters have been inundated with new people seeking help, according to a recent article from the New York Times. An average of 10% of people being served by homeless shelters lost their homes to foreclosure over the last year, says a coalition of housing advocates. That rate was even higher in the Midwest, where 15% of newly homeless had lost homes to foreclosure. Shelters are doing what they can to accommodate the newly homeless, but the transition is turning out to be more difficult for those now in need, homeowners who thought they'd always have a roof over their heads. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, Chicago's sustainability guru Sadhu Johnston joins us to talk about greening the second city and his new position with the city of Vancouver. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Last month, the city of Chicago got some disappointing news as Sadhu Johnston announced he would be leaving his post as the city's chief environmental officer and moving to become deputy mayor of Vancouver, British Columbia. Sadhu has overseen many green initiatives in the city, and before he left town, we caught up with him to discuss how cities all over North America and worldwide are working together to combat climate change. Sadhu, your tenure as the City of Chicago's sustainability guru is coming to a close. You were a pioneer in the field, clearly. How long have you been at this?
Here in Chicago for 6 years. Before that, in Cleveland, from a nonprofit perspective, for 5 years. So I've been working to green cities for the last over 10 years.
You began your work on sustainability in Chicago as a special assistant to the mayor, the first on sustainability. With little budget, no staff. Your job was to influence division directors to get their budgets and their staffs on the sustainability path, to use those sustainability practices in their divisions. Were you successful at doing that?
So when I sat down with the mayor and said, "So I'm starting, what do you want me to do?" The first thing he said is, "We need ownership across all of the city departments." And so the first thing I did was create this environmental action agenda. It took us about a year, and each of the key commissioners for those departments were charged with leading a task force to explore what they needed to do in their own area. So I didn't come in and start telling people, you have to do this, you have to do that. We helped them to define what made the most sense for their departments. And I think it was very successful. It gave people a roadmap for what do we need to do? Where's the opportunity? Where are the challenges? What are we benchmarked? What other places are doing? We brought in people from the outside to sit on these task forces to advise us. And it was one of the most comprehensive action plans of its kind in the country. Over 100 pages of benchmarking what we needed to do, developing goals. And I think it was very successful in setting a roadmap for these commissioners who are hearing about this, hearing the mayor tell them to do this, but didn't have a clear sense of what role they were to play. This is not their area of focus. And so I think it really helped to set the stage. And so I would say, yeah, we were successful.
I've been told, not once, but multiple times, that plans are not particularly welcomed in the city of Chicago, that it's much more of, let's go do it. And there's a sense that a plan or a strategy is going to really slow us down. That wasn't your experience?
No, I think that sense is the mayor likes action. Mayor Daley really likes to see things happening. And so my various plan development programs that I've done here in the city of Chicago is that we're constantly implementing. So in my opinion, you can't do a two-year plan while you're not doing it. I mean, you have to be implementing. And that's the same with the climate action plan that we developed as well. As soon as we were realizing where the emissions were coming from and that we needed to target existing buildings, we were going out there meeting with the folks and already pushing this agenda. So I think plans have to be actionable and they have to be implemented as they go. Like that, I just don't think it would work here to set everything aside, develop a plan for 2 years, and then launch the plan and hope people will implement it.
What's been your toughest challenge?
Real change. Getting people to build green buildings, to tweak what they're doing. We've been very successful. We have more green buildings underway in the city of Chicago than any other city. More certified than any other city, more green roofs than any other city. There's a lot that we've done that's been kind of exciting new things to do. And everyone's on the bandwagon, wants to be the greenest city, wants to be a part of it. But talking about real change is a struggle. And one example is waste franchising. Thinking about how we collect waste in the city of Chicago, the waste industry is largely unregulated. And the business community didn't want to step up and we didn't want to step up to really have that battle. And I think that's a struggle, is actually getting people to change how they do things. There's no one to blame for that. It's just we're used to things the way things are, and going to the business community to tell them that we're going to change things and that they should trust us, that's a big leap of faith for them. And so I can't blame anybody for that, but change is sometimes tough.
Looking back on it, do you think there's anything you could have done to accelerate change?
Well, I think we have. I think we've seen incredible change in Chicago. And in the time that I've been here, and certainly before when I got here, Mayor Daley has been a pioneer of change and has been an incredible role model in that, internally and externally. So in saying that that's a challenge, I don't think that we haven't done a lot and stepped up a lot. I really think we have. I mean, Chicago is recognized as an international leader on this. And 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we weren't. And so I think there's huge change that's happened across all sectors, and even in homeowners changing how they recycle or how they get to work. So I think we've made incredible progress.
You still sound like there's some frustration that even though you've made incredible progress, you see progress that could have been made that wasn't, just because change is hard, and change is hard for any of us on any subject. So again, just looking back, can you say, if I had just done it this way, or if we had been able to convince this particular group, I mean, is there a path that you think would have accelerated change?
I think the role that I play as chief environmental officer, I think there's a balance between steering and rowing. You kind of have to steer the ship and shape the policy, and at times you need to get in there and just row. I think there's greater strength in the steering. I'd like to have found a way to steer more.
You led the development of the Chicago Climate Change Action Plan. What is the significance of that plan? What does it mean for Chicago, especially relative to other cities?
So I co-led the development of Chicago Climate Action Plan with Adele Simmons and staff at the Department of Environment and across many city departments. So I wouldn't say I was the leader. I was one of the team that did it. The significance, as we started to get into it, we looked around at climate action plans from the leading cities that we look to. Pretty much all of the examples that we saw were cities outlining what they were going to do to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And in many ways, they were like a laundry list of things that should be done. We wanted to take a totally different approach, which was to understand how climate change was already impacting the city and how it would impact us over the next 80, 90 years. Really long-range thinking. And have scientists do that analysis to develop for us a picture of what could happen in Chicago if we took action collectively around the globe and if we didn't. And that gave us a really good picture of what's happening in Chicago. And for the first time, any of our city leaders said, wow, that's why we've got so many potholes, or that's why we've been seeing so much more urban flooding. It explained things that we had already seen but that hadn't all put together. And we developed a plan based on that information, scientifically grounded plan. And we did an incredible baseline analysis to understand where our emissions are coming from. And we made goals, quantifiable million metric ton targets that we were going to pursue, and strategies, actions to go with those. And so it was the first plan in the country, if not the world, that I've seen that was built on science like that, founded on science, peer-reviewed science, with actual quantifiable goals by each of those actions. And we really tried to overlay this adaptation approach of trying to build a resilient city with the mitigation or the attempts to reduce the emissions. And I think what you're seeing a lot around the country is you've got these plans that are outlining the ways that we can reduce our emissions, and at the same time, cities are taking action to address the changes that they're seeing, and those efforts aren't overlapping. And so there's this overlap between adaptation and mitigation, this sweet spot where you can take an action like a green roof and address multiple of those issues. You're cooling the city, you're supporting wildlife, you're making it easier to air condition that building, which is reducing your need to produce greenhouse gases. And so there's a whole suite of opportunities like that where you can meet multiple functions, whereas if all you're doing is thinking about, okay, it's getting warmer, we need to add air conditioning to our buildings, your adaptation strategy is creating a massive burden on greenhouse gases.
You just convened your peers, 60 plus of your peers from around the North America, right? Who are all working on sustainability strategies for their cities. Did you come out of that meeting hopeful?
Extremely. So 6 years ago when Mayor Daley brought me into the office to focus on this, I didn't really know anyone else that was in a chief environmental officer type of position, a very high level in government that's leading the charge on this. And slowly over the years, I've run into people as that position has grown and realized we need to get together. We need to be sharing stories. We need to be building a network. And so this gathering was the largest gathering of its kind in the world, as far as we know. People that are dedicated to sustainable development in their cities, so the urban sustainability directors. And this was the launch of our Urban Sustainability Directors Network. And we've gotten funding from the Home Depot Foundation and Rockefeller Brothers Fund and CERDNA. A number of foundations said, this is an important group, and we need to support them in building that experience so that we can call each other and not redo everything that another city's already done. And so this gathering was incredible, and I leave feeling just so hopeful, extremely excited about the growth of this movement. 68% of the participants, the positions they were in were 3 years old or less. So this is a just exponentially growing field right now, and as such, there's no sharing, there's no association, there's no websites to support us. I mean, it's really brand new. So it's very exciting that we're connecting, we're sharing stories. The media and all these rating systems love to compare us. They love to say Chicago's greener than New York or Toronto's greener than Chicago, and develop their own ways of judging that. And we're coming together saying, yeah, you can make us compete with each other, but fundamentally, we're on a mission. And that mission is to make our cities better, to improve our quality of life in our cities, and to reduce the impact that our cities have on the environment. And those people all cared about each other at the end of this 3 days, and that was very exciting.
What are the biggest changes that would have to occur to achieve the goals of these sustainability directors around North America? I mean, what are they trying to do that they haven't yet done?
There's a different title for each of these people. They're in different parts of city government. They define their goals differently. So it's very homegrown, each of these. And each one, in many ways, has their own framework for what their goals are, what their focus areas are, opportunities, leverage points, metrics, indicators. Every city sustainability director has this own framework that they've effectively made on their own, in certain cases spent a lot of money making. And I'm a part of an effort called STAR Community Index, which is really trying to build out a framework that all these cities can tap into, and new cities that are just getting into it can tap into it. So 10 years ago, LEED, or Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, was a green building system, was developed to define what is a green building. We need that for cities. What is a green city? What is a sustainable city? How do you define it? How do you go farther? What are the key strategies? So what's the framework to do that? How do you measure it? And how do you certify it? Because we're all being compared against each other with different metrics. I get calls from reporters saying, well, one city's recycling rate is X percent and yours is X percent, and why are they doing so much better than you are? Well, because they include the dredgings from their harbor, and they include the recycling of abandoned cars. And so we're all being compared to each other, but we don't have a common way to define what a recycling percentage is or how many square feet of green roofs you include. Do you include an extensive green roof or an intensive green roof? So we're now coming together. Cities are developing a system for cities by cities rather than some third-party organization, an advocacy group with its own agenda, developing metrics, or a newspaper developing metrics. If the Chicago Tribune wants to compare us to other cities and they've got an agenda to make us look bad, they're going to create metrics that we're going to look bad on. But this system that we're developing is allowing us to all be on a level playing field and to recognize that there are background levels, brownfield issues that we may have here that Portland may not. So we may not score well on number of brownfields, but we may have done a lot more to address brownfield issues. So there's a level of performance, a accountability. So there's a metrics that we're including in this, which is just a great system that we're going to have to drive this agenda across all cities.
You're leaving Chicago. You're going to Vancouver. Why?
Well, I've been here 6 years, and I feel like I've had an ability to contribute a lot to the movement here in Chicago, and I feel blessed and really fortunate to have had that opportunity. And I wasn't looking to move, and when I got a call from a headhunter saying, would you be interested in Vancouver, I was intrigued by the idea. My wife has said to me before, the only place I will ever leave Chicago for is Vancouver. And so when I got the call, it seemed like something worth exploring, and I went out, met with the city manager, met with the mayor, and was just really inspired by what they're doing. I'm a dual citizen, so it feels like home in a way, too. And I love nature. To be able to leave nature for mountain biking or hiking or camping without it taking a two-hour drive is pretty exciting, too.
I want to ask you about the green jobs opportunity. We've heard so much about green jobs. In some ways, I feel like it's the sort of the new biotech, right? It's going to solve our jobs problem. I'd love to hear your perspective on the real potential for green jobs in America.
When biotech was happening 10, 15 years ago, and every city was talking about biotech, and I kind of kept saying, well, think about green tech, think about green tech. And now that it's finally here, I'm kind of saying, well, what does this really mean? My feeling is that green jobs and green tech will be a great part of the solution, but it's not going to get us out of the mess that we're in. In many ways, the system that we are all a part of that drives our economy, building McMansions in the suburbs so that people will go out and buy appliances and drive more, and this whole system has some structural challenges to it, in my opinion. And green jobs aren't going to solve those challenges. We will come into resource issues, whether it's gasoline or water or land or landfill space. We have challenges, and climate is demonstrating that, climate change. So I think green jobs, though, for a city like Chicago, will play a wonderful role in filling out our economy. And there are great opportunities. And I think one of the differences that I think that we have with the biotech is that this can be homegrown. There are great companies here in our cities, like Chicago, that we can grow, that we can help them to get additional market share, so they own this. We don't have to go out to look for that great green company to bring here. We can develop resources to help our own companies to grow green. And I think that's the real opportunity, is to help that window manufacturer make a super energy efficient window, or that dry cleaner be the greenest dry cleaner, or that packaging company to be the most environmentally friendly packaging company. And this can be an opportunity to export our companies, to export our technology, keeping them here, but allowing them to grow and move into other places. So to me, that's a great opportunity. The other opportunity, I think, is taking some of these opportunities to disadvantaged populations, people that haven't had opportunities in the past, ex-offenders, homeless populations. A lot of these jobs, be they installing a green roof or installing a solar panel or retrofitting a home, you don't do those from another city or from another country. You need your people locally. And a lot of those are kind of low-tech jobs. They can be trained pretty quickly. So I think there's real opportunities if we don't get hung up on the definition, because a green job is very hard to define. It's really hard to say, is if you're cleaning up a brownfield site, or is it a green job? If you're an engineer doing the design for that, is it a green job? And I think we could spin our wheels trying to define it, and rather we just got to kind of know it when you see it, and we can grow this industry by growing the companies that are involved in it.
If you could simply command people to do anything that would make a significant difference in climate change, what would you have us do?
I think the biggest thing would be to change how you get to work. Get out of your car. And it's not just work. It's most of our trips are not to and from work in our car. It's less than 4 miles going to the store. And I just think if we get more people out of their cars, that would be, and that has so many co-benefits. People will be healthier. Our neighborhoods would be safer. People will be walking around. You'd have more eyes on the street. And we'd have less space for cars and more space for people. And so I think just the car culture that we've built in the U.S. here is damaging to the climate and to our communities. So I'd say there's a lot of co-benefits to getting people out of their cars. The second thing is just thinking about how we use energy in our buildings. And that's a little bit harder. It's a lot harder than getting out of your car, because you can make that decision in the morning on your way to work. But we need to think about how we use energy in our buildings, and we need to change that. And it's just turning off lights behind you. It's running your washer on cold instead of on hot. Simple things that we can do.
Why haven't we been able to organize large-scale energy retrofits for residential properties and finance it out of energy savings? I'm baffled by this. It seems like a no-brainer.
Doing energy retrofits for residential buildings is more expensive than commercial or industrial. We've got a lot of different issues. Homeowners may not trust who's showing up to their door. We've did some surveying here at the Center for Cultural Understanding in Chicago and asked people in the neighborhoods, who do you trust? Where do you get your information? And it's not the city, and it's not the utility. It's the church group, it's the community leader. And we haven't empowered those folks, the leaders that are providing that information, we haven't empowered them to help to make this transformation. So fundamentally, I don't think we've been using the right resources to get information out. That's just the first thing, is just kind of how to drive this. I think the value of energy efficiency isn't understood. When you go and buy a car nowadays, everybody asks, what's the miles per gallon? You wouldn't ever, very few people would buy a car without asking that nowadays. Do you know what to ask when you buy or rent your home? There's no metric. There's no miles per gallon for a home. What if every time you were going to rent an office or buy a building, buy a home, buy a condo, you got a score and it said F? You're about to rent a home or buy a home that's got an F as an energy score. If that was going to happen, and it could be energy intensity per square foot, how much does it cost to heat and cool this building for a year, and how does it compare to other buildings in the community? If you got an F, chances are the person that was about to sell you that home would make those improvements before they gave it to you. So I think we need a metric so that people will start to value this, and brokers will know how to talk about it. Beyond that, to your finance question, I think we don't have too many people from a finance background that have been working on this issue. You have environmentalists saying we need to do energy retrofits. And they may know the technology, but they don't know the financing behind it. And so we need to develop a metric. And then in my opinion, we need to go neighborhood by neighborhood. We need to get some economies of scale. And we could say, Wednesday, October 10th, we're going to be on your street and we're going to be blowing insulation in homes. Here's the subsidy that we're going to provide for you. Would you like us to do it in your home? And just go door to door rather than a truck mobilizing to go out and do 5 hours worth of work and then packing up and going across the city to another location. So I think we need to ramp up. And ultimately, we need to find financial tools to take advantage of the energy savings and to be able to quantify that for people.
I assume cities are in very different places in their sustainability journeys. Is that all about leadership?
I don't think it's all about leadership. I think a lot of it is about the constituency, the residents. Are they asking for this? Are they doing it on their own? If enough people want something, they're going to push their leader to do it, whether their leader cares about it or not. So I think a lot of it is on what people are asking for, what their concerns about, and what they're driving their leaders to do, because leaders respond to their constituents. So in a city like Chicago, the leadership of Mayor Daley is what's driven this movement, because the constituents generally won't see the value of it until you've done it. And so when he started planting trees 20 years ago, people were saying, why are you spending money planting trees? And then these trees get big and beautiful and people want to stay in their neighborhoods because it's a beautiful, shady street. Then they see the value of it. So I think some really visionary leaders like Mayor Daley see the value that it's going to provide. But generally, I think there's a strong role that residents have to play in driving the movement.
Sadhu, much good luck in Vancouver. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thanks, Carol, for your leadership.
Sadhu Johnston is formerly Chicago's chief environmental officer and is soon becoming deputy mayor of Vancouver, British Columbia.
Finally, this week, politics can be messy business. But when the tenor of the discourse turns ugly, our City Views commentator begins searching for common ground.
The cover of a recent issue of New York Magazine pictured a silhouette of President Obama with the word hate stamped on it in big block letters. The cover story was about the so-called Obama crazies who have lost their minds over things like Obama's birth country or his true religion. Indeed, racial hate crimes in America are up since Obama was elected. The smoldering volcano of hatred in this netherworld of extremism is respiring with fresh menace, like that long shot of Mount Doom that closes out the second installment of the Lord of the Rings movie trilogy. And the ash spewed forth has settled on all of us. No need to recount South Carolina Representative Joe Wilson's unseemly outburst during President Obama's nationally televised healthcare speech to a joint session of Congress. No need to add anything to the video footage all over YouTube of shrieking hordes piling into the August town hall meetings. No need to repeat all of the things circulating online or being said on talk radio during this healthcare debate. No need to worry more about House Speaker John Boehner's use of the inflammatory word rebellion to describe the kind of resistance he feels is appropriate these days. But there probably is a need to remind ourselves that this kind of incendiary debate leaves no one unaffected. Indeed, across the aisle, Democratic Congressman Alan Grayson described the Republican health care plan as, quote-unquote, don't get sick, and if you do get sick, die quickly. The ash of odium has spared no one. Yet we need to resist the temptation to engage in rabble-rousing. The more we fight, the less civil society we have to share. It's hard for us to see this from inside our ideological cocoons. Indeed, we don't even realize the extent to which the echo chamber of our beliefs turns us into extremists. But social psychologists have found that the more time we spend with people who think just like us, the more extreme we get in our opinions. It's a funny kind of thing, but having our beliefs reinforced by others makes us more certain of these beliefs and thus less accepting of criticism. It also pushes us to extremes as we try naturally to be different rather than be in lockstep with others around us. We all put a premium on individuality, and the only way to stand out when everyone thinks like us without going in the complete opposite direction is to go to even further extremes on the continuum of things that we believe. Americans love to talk politics, but the politics we talk is with people who think like us. University of Pennsylvania political scientist Diana Mutz has found that less than one quarter of Americans actually talk regularly with people who disagree with them politically. But there is something that can bring us together, something that psychologist Gordon Allport identified in the 1950s. And that is a goal shared among a team of equals. A common goal can bridge our differences. And that's where I think politics has gone off track these days. We've forgotten that deep underneath all the charges and countercharges is a shared American belief in the individual and the freedoms, liberties, and obligations associated with the individual. To oversimplify a bit, but to cut to the chase, conservatives fear that government is an intrusion on individualism, while liberals believe that government is essential to creating opportunities for individualism to succeed. But everyone agrees that the core essence of America is individualism. We fight over what government must do or not do for individualism to reign true, but we don't fight over the core value placed upon individual liberties and achievements. The debate we should be having is not one of arguing about government. We should be focusing on enabling individuals to succeed. And if we could just reframe the debate, we could find the common ground we share and move beyond the outlandish incivility that is driving us apart. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelevich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He comes to us each week from Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. That's all for this week's show, but there's more Smart City online. At smartcityradio.com, you can listen to archive shows, read my blog, and subscribe to our weekly newsletter. You can also let us know how we're doing by emailing us at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. I'm Carol Coletta.